Welcome to Out of the Blank.
Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. I'm here with Peter. Peter, for everyone out there listening, tell them a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you write about, maybe.
Yeah, sure. I do, Robbie. Thanks for the invitation here. Well, today, I consider myself an author and an advocate for the rights of the donor conceived, who have been really disregarded by the very industry that enabled their conception to begin with. Three factors impacted the evolution of my frame of reference in terms of the person that I became. Number one, a somewhat dysfunctional childhood, disruptive, a working class family, a sick dad, moved many times, somewhat of an unstable life in 11 different school districts in several states between the first and the eighth grade. That shaped my adaptability, let's say. A state college education, fine state university, first in my family, opened many doors of opportunity for me. And then on the ground service as a special operations team leader in Vietnam somewhat shaped my leadership style. Well, all of that was fine, but I took my DNA for granted. And all of a sudden I'm learning that, hey, I'm not Northern Italian. As a matter of fact, I learned that my dad wasn't biological at all. In 1995, that was quite a while ago, I was a 49-year-old high-tech CEO specializing in companies that had run aground facing difficulty, and I was the guy getting them out of difficulty. My 75-year-old mother was stroke recovering from a post-operative stroke. And she spilled the beans that dad wasn't biological. He was, in fact, sterile. And they had gone to a Harvard Medical School-based fertility clinic to get some advice. And the advice was, well, you got three choices. You can remain childless, one. You can adopt a child, two. Or do this newfangled thing that we have, which is anonymous sperm donor. Trust me, I'll get the right kind of a donor to match the husband as best I can. And the term at the time was semi-adopted, if artificial insemination by donor had such negative overtones where a woman was considered an adulteress and a child considered illegitimate legally, if one were to have them by an anonymous sperm donor. Then the term semi-adoption was used as a way of diffusing some of that negativity. Well, nothing changed for me, but everything changed for me at that moment in time when I learned that my heritage wasn't my heritage and that my birth certificate was a hoax. My dad suffered from bouts of depression. He was younger, he could shake it off. Until he couldn't shake it off anymore. He was hospitalized over several years and took his own life when I was 16 years old. Old school Italian family wanted to keep that quiet. They viewed it as a flaw. Let not that flaw get spilled over onto them. So I grew up keeping that very hushed as well and feeling somewhat inadequate and flawed myself. Now, I always felt a little different, too. I was fair-complected, had my dad's crystal blue eyes, the Northern Italian blue eyes, but always felt a little bit different. Fair hair, fair eyes, fair complexion. My academic and my life's achievements, my family on both sides actually were somewhat intimidated by that as well. And I was confused and conflicted when I learned this thing. I mean, how can you feel deceived and relieved all at the same time? How do you feel angry and sad or shame and pride or empty and fulfilled all at the same time? It was really confusing.
I'm conflicted because the rights to not know who your biological father is when it comes to sperm donation, for instance, at a sperm bank, you can just sign something. There's a movie called Delivery Man with Vince Vaughn, and he has like 500 something kids because they just used his sperm. And all these kids are fighting to know who their father is. Now, the importance of that is you want to know who your parent is so you could look at like maybe health effects, damages, for instance, if you're going to have like a propensity to this or that, genetic things. But the horrors of it also, too, of just feeling like you want to find out where you're from, mostly understanding yourself more because you have this idea of who you are based on the two people that are around or the person that you know from what you've been told, and then finding out something different has got to be you might have been older when it came to the information that maybe some kids might feel sensitive to it. You still feel lost though. Like even if you're 50, if you're 60, if you find out what you've been told was a different story than the actual truth, it just got to feel like you're on a mission to find out who you are in a sense.
Yeah, that mission burned in me, Robbie. The psychologists call it genealogical bewilderment. That's something that came about in research in the 60s, actually, when they were looking at the research around adoptees and some of the problems of adjustment and feeling of belonging that adoptees had. There is a burn inside of one to understand one's genetics. For me, I was looking for three things. I wanted to know what was my genealogy, number one. What was my genealogical health history, number two. I mean, I had feared for a long time that this mental illness might pass on to me or to my offspring. So it was important that I had some sort of understanding of my paternal gene pool from a health standpoint. And raised as an only child, I asked myself, do I have any siblings? In my research, I uncovered a word that I had never heard before, Robbie. It was misattributed. Now, I knew other miswords, you know, misnomer, misunderstood, misconceived, but never misattributed. Misattributed means that your birth certificate and your DNA just don't jive with one or both parents. And the experts, in quotes, the experts believe that some 2-4% of us are misattributed. Some think it's a little less than that. Some make a very cogent case that it's much more than that, but many will get their head around the 2-4% as a talking point. So let's just use that 2-4%. So how can that be that you're misattributed? Well, you could be a late discovery adoptee, a closed adoption. You could be the product of an extramarital affair or a one-night stand or perhaps an unreported sexual assault. You may have been switched at birth, or perhaps Aunt Martha raised you. You thought she was mom, but Cousin Mary was your mom. That happens in families today. You're actually raised by another family member. Or like me, semi-adopted with an anonymous gamete donor, sperm or egg or even embryo, and not actually know it. The experts also believe that some 1 million of us are donor conceived. And in the old days, donor conception was riddled with lots of secrecy. You had anonymous donors. You had birth certificates that were set up by the obstetrician who did not know that the wife was artificially inseminated. Therefore, he could legitimately sign a birth certificate stating that the husband was the father. That was certainly in my case as well. My birth certificate was a hoax in that regard. This was the whole process. And once I learned late discovery that I was misattributed, I went through a significant amount of trauma, identity trauma. And I sought some therapy to help me out. And my therapist said that I had hit a trifecta because old trauma oftentimes rekindles, new trauma rather, oftentimes rekindles old trauma long thought past. And for me, it was my disruptive childhood and death of my dad. I never really properly grieved for him, and he had died some 33 years prior to my discovery that I was misattributed by an anonymous sperm donor. And the impact of war in Vietnam, where I had camouflaged some of my PTSD from that experience. So all three of these things erupted in me, and I was dealing with all three as opposed to one at the time that I had sought some therapy. So it was a difficult time frame.
So what your thoughts on it now? Do you think it should just be like the process should be just riddled out completely? Like it shouldn't be around at all? Or do you think it should just be like more open to the idea of giving the proper information for people to be able to trace back their roots? Because I think people should know where they come from. But at the same time, there's just a lot of people out there now, especially with how worse the times are getting, that just can't have kids like at all. But I just don't think that information should be kept secret. I mean, even if sometimes even a parent feels like it's their opportunity to take that to the grave, you know, keep that secret locked. And that's an issue for the kid. Like, even if they don't know that they're adopted, maybe if they never find out, they should still be given the opportunity to know as well, too.
Yeah, it is an issue for the kids, Robbie. I'm all for science enabling a wanting group of people to have a family. That's just fine. And donors have rights and the recipients have rights. But I don't see any laws on the books protecting the rights of the donor conceived. In 21st century technology, through DNA analysis, anonymity is obsolete. Yet people can still get an anonymous donor, egg, sperm, embryo. There's no law on the books requiring genetic testing or the recording of a genetic health history of a donor-conceived child. There's no law on the books requiring or restricting the numbers of children to be conceived from any one donor. There are donor-conceived children that have over 100 siblings unknown to them. There's no sibling registry to enable siblings to know of one another. There's no counseling required by law of the donor or the recipient regarding the needs of the donor-conceived child. And today, there's no law on the books dissuading or penalizing what we call fertility fraud. For instance, a doctor may choose to use his own sperm. That's happened in many cases, countless times on his patients, unbeknownst to them. Or a gamete distributor may substitute one selection for another, and you don't get the sperm or the egg that you actually selected. So the issues around the practice of assisted reproductive technology are the issues that I just outlined. That really needs a Bill of Rights, a donor-conceived Bill of Rights. Once again, I'm all in favor of science enabling a wanting couple to have a family. And the sociology has radically changed over the last several decades, Robbie. There was a time where a heterosexual couple was the only one seeking artificial insemination by a donor. And some 10 to 15% of couples have fertility issues, half of them relating to the man, half of them relating to the woman. Maybe in 20% of the cases, they're each having fertility issues. But today, there's plenty of same-sex couples defying biology and going the assisted reproductive technology route through a gamete donor, whether it be egg or sperm, to have a family. And there are single people as well that enable that family. So the sociology has changed, but the practice is still using 20th century methodology.
What are some things besides just advocating for this? Because I think a large amount is probably people just not understanding or not being keen on the information that you're speaking about, which is why it probably hasn't changed in so long. But what I'm kind of in fear of right now is the way that we're going with gene editing, the way that we're going with a lot of these new future tech ways to have a kid, or more, I guess, technologically advanced ways of being able to conceive a kid. We got to make sure that there's proper guidelines in place for someone to be able to figure out when it's the coming from the spawn or the kid's perspective, like what's going to be there for them and their rights and their aspects of things as well too. And there's been a large gap of, I feel like, a lot of people who make these laws or these regulations. This was a foreign thing for a lot of people for a long, at least for as many people as they know, it was a foreign thing to be, you know, conceived in this aspect. And now we're heading into this area where you're seeing fertility numbers, they're lower than they've ever been. And they're just increasing with the number of phthalates from plastics. Our plastic consumption is insane. There's recent studies now being done about that, but reproductive health is one thing I've been getting interested in, because you're coming across a lot of kids my age, for instance, that can't have kids, or they have a misfunction to them about their sexual prowess only because the amount of antidepressants that they're on, which have been distributed over the last time. These are all factors that are boiling to a point of why this technology with gene editing, CRISPR, all these types of things are going to be very, very applicable to a lot of these aspects, which if we don't fix the problem that you're discussing upon, which is the rights to these kids, these things that are going on, because there's no stopping the technology, it's going to increase. But we can make safety guidelines and measures to not only for the protection of the donor, but the protection of the conceived as well, too, the person that is being created from all of this as well, too, because the mental implications are just vast in amount. I mean, I might be rambling on here, but I think that's of prime importance.
Now, you brought up a lot of good points, and it really points that came out in my research, Robbie. When I learned that I was misattributed by an anonymous sperm donor in 1995 is when I learned it. Google was 3 years away from being founded, and 21st century DNA technology was 12 years away from its first innovation. There were no records kept, and my mother misremembered the name of the doctor and the address of the doctor. So I just was researching and finding stone walls. And to somewhat be therapeutic for me, I did a deep dive of research into the scientific, the legal, and the sociological history and the evolution of assisted reproductive technology, from actually biblical references right through to today. With 21st century technology, I spit in a vial in 2007, or actually early 2008, and did a 23andMe test, which was the first company that did this in late 2007. They actually were Time Magazine's Innovation of the Year in 2007. And I learned from that I wasn't Northern Italian. I was English, French, and a sliver of Scandinavian. Okay, I can live with that, but I never found a paternal relative on that 23andMe site. And I thought if I just wait for several years or a period of time for that database to build up, I'll find a paternal relative and be able to find the source of my seed. 9 years later, I was still frustrated because no paternal relative showed up on that. And my kids encouraged me, my now adult children, my son and my daughter, encouraged me to look at Ancestry.com, who went into the field in 2012 as an expansion of their family tree business, computerized records and of family members and so forth to do computerized family trees. And by 2017, they had actually had a database that far surpassed 23andMe's database. So I went ahead and I spit in the 23andMe vial. Now, technology really advances. I spent $999 for 23andMe in 2008. And I spent $99 for Ancestry.com in 2017. Remember, a mainframe computer in the 70s was $1 million. And now the power of a mainframe computer you hold in the palm of your hand for $100,000. The same concept is true in DNA technology, I have learned. And it was with that that I actually found the source of my seed, found, reinforced what my genealogy was, found that my genealogical health history was solid. And I learned that I did have some siblings. And there's one question that still is open to me. How many siblings do I have really? Every February, we call it new sibling season. 2 million people sign up to the likes of other DNA analysis companies to get a Black Friday special, maybe $49. And those 2 million people enter the database. Some small percentage of them are actually donor conceived, maybe don't know it. So last February, I was able to find a new sister who was 5 months younger than I, born in the same proximity to me. What I learned in my research actually were the 10 top secrets of reproductive technology. The first one was that artificial insemination was actually perfected through animal husbandry. And the mad scientist who attempted to do a hybrid human ape was ultimately exiled by Stalin, and he was nicknamed Red Frankenstein. The first artificial insemination took place, when do you think? It was alleged to have taken place by a medieval king in 1462 to help enable the continuation of his line to the throne. It was documented by a doctor for the English court in the 18th century, and further documented by a donor in a hospital in Philadelphia in 1884 under somewhat criminal circumstances. And when that first came to light in 1909, the church and state drove the whole practice of assisted reproductive technology underground in a shroud of secrecy. Actually, at the time that I was conceived, Robbie, in 1945, Time magazine had written an article in the legal section, and they were reviewing a case in the Superior Court in Illinois where a husband was granted a divorce on the grounds of adultery because his wife was inseminated by an anonymous sperm donor, and the child was declared to be, in quotes, illegitimate. Now, the title of that article, what do you think the title was? Artificial Bastards with a question mark. So I actually used Artificial Bastards as a working title when I first decided to write this book. Well, if church and state drove assisted reproductive technology underground, the early practice in the early 20th century carried a eugenics tone, eugenics being selective breeding. You had to be among the chosen. And back to animal husbandry, experimenting on the farm actually froze bull semen and enabled the birth of the first cow from frozen bull semen was named Frosty. And that technology actually enabled the entirety of the sperm banks that we have today. You mentioned fertility rates. Fertility rates are down over the last four decades by 50%, 50%. And it's a combination of factors, Robbie. You mentioned one, which was the toxicity in the environment. And the other one is that people are just waiting longer and the biological clock isn't necessarily working in their favor when they wait longer to have a family. But the population of donor-conceived people is up by as much as 50% just in the last decade. You have much more of a social acceptance of assisted reproductive technology today. And the field is wider than just couples having fertility issues, because same-sex couples and single people are also in the equation.
Do you think that's just because of misunderstanding? Like when people, like I misdonated sperm one time, it was just a thought that I had, mostly because you can get paid and you're looking at people that are young that need money or something like that, just want money. They only tell you that option, but then you got to kind of think it through a little bit, which a kid who's like 26 or whatever age, a young person, or just someone who is struggling for money, it's not really thinking about the whole ramifications of what that entails, which is the fact that you're sending out basically someone to use your genetic code and recreate life, where you're going to be a parent, but that kid's not going to know who the original father is or whoever it is. I mean, it's a big issue. There's a lot, like we talked about before, about eugenics. That's the biggest ethical thing with CRISPR right now and gene editing, is if you know the psychology behind what a kid must deal with not knowing who his parents are or who his original parent is, then you can understand that people want to edit, go from editing autism out of a child to, I want my baby to have blue eyes. And then you start developing this perfect human type thing where it leads down the road of eugenics. I mean, there's a lot of ethical implications, but you only ever hear the positives be spoken about. You never hear the negatives. And it's just like, that's a whole other perspective, I feel like, that needs to be brought to the table. And it's necessarily pushed underground. I think the only reason why you're seeing this technology advance so far forward, like you mentioned, the church driving it underground, religion is not as dominant as it was before. And that's where you can get away with a lot of these marks of people heading towards these technological shifts. And you're seeing ethical boundaries be questioned and pushed.
Well, you mentioned ethics, and that's a key thing. Science is going to continue to evolve, and there's no stopping science. And sociology is oftentimes well behind science, but eventually it tries to catch up. Now, the 21st century technology has really obsoleted the practices of assisted reproductive technology today, the anonymity and the secrecy, but it's still in practice and there's no laws preventing that. There's another Red Frankenstein yet to be nicknamed. In Monash University last year, they were able to construct a model embryo from cellular matter, skin. No egg, no sperm. Now, we have cloning of sheep and cocker spaniels on the farm. But mark my words, without any sort of regulation around the ethics, science will continue to advance, and there's another Red Frankenstein out there.
Eventually, I mean, it'll be pushed over into humans. That goal line always moves. Starts off with animals and then it moves over.
3 years ago, there was a Chinese doctor who used CRISPR technology to edit some genes for the birth of a child. He was thrown in jail for 3 years. We'll see what happens with the use of CRISPR technology and the use of the model embryo, but there's no denying that science will continue to advance. So there needs to be some rules in the game, well ahead of the game.
Yeah.
To help get some guidance.
I don't see it stopping, but I don't necessarily know if I want it to stop. I just think there needs to be some really ethically brought questions to the table when it comes to a lot of these aspects of things. And sadly, when you're so involved in a technology like this, like if you're working for it and you're innovating it forward, you're not paying attention to all these questions that an outside perspective raises in, especially a perspective like you have from the experience you've developed in researching into this. You start seeing a bunch of, and it is foresight in a way. People would call it Monday quarterbacking or something like that, but that's not really what it is. In a sense, you're a head that should be brought to the table as well too. Like I said, you have a perspective that's different than what the general public probably knows about this stuff, because everybody's told the goods, they're never really told the bad. And I think that needs, like I said, needs to be brought to the table.
Well, you know, we have the industries don't police themselves particularly well. We have an assisted reproductive technology industry that's multi-billions of dollars. Just the distribution of sperm alone is a business that will be approaching $5 billion by 2025. Now, that's not that far off. That's a large enough of a marketplace and growing fast enough to attract the likes of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, wouldn't you think? But industries don't police themselves particularly well. And we have, for instance, the SEC, we have the FDA, we have the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. There's the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act and the National Organ Transplant Act, all around protecting people from rogue practices. Yet the assisted reproductive technology industry is a self-regulated industry with flawed and obsolete practices. It's going to continue to be an issue. Now, there's a patchwork quilt of activity on a state-by-state basis, taking this piece or that piece of the donor-conceived Bill of Rights that I had outlined and trying to put some regulation around that. I'm hopeful that my book, which is a combination of a very intimate memoir and a deep dive of expose on the practices of assisted reproductive technology, I'm hopeful that that shines a beacon of light on this thing and brings about some positive influence and change on the whole practice of assisted reproductive technology. I'm all for the practice if it's done according to some degree of legitimate standard. You know, I had a friend who used to breed Rottweilers, and I exposed him to what I learned of my own heritage and the whole industry. And he gave me a very interesting perspective. He said, you know, Peter, there are more rules on the books, there are more laws, there's more legislative oversight to the breeding of puppies than there are for the conception of human beings. Think about that.
I mean, that makes sense. Just because I think people feel like a human consciousness or human thing, people would be able to decipher out ethical things on their own, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I think money is a big incentive to people doing the worst possible choice sometimes as well too.
Well, in God we trust and the rest pay cash.
Have you had anybody reach out to you about this book? Either people that have had the same experience or had this type of longing for no, because I mean, I'm a big person when it comes to understanding your family history. I don't necessarily look towards a database to do so. I just like to hear the stories from my ancestors that are alive or my grandparents, my great grandparents. When they were alive, I would like to hear as much as they could possibly remember. But a lot of people who are in adopted scenarios, for instance, one of my first episodes of my show, my 9th episode, Corey, that's my cousin. Now, I didn't know he was my cousin until he popped up on our doorstep and he said, I'm your cousin. And we found out he's our long lost cousin. My grandma had 4 kids. One died of cancer at the age of like 24 or something like that. And nobody knew he had a kid. And we found this kid in his 30s and he comes to us. And that whole episode was just me learning about him for the first time. Now, he did move away, but he stayed with us for a little while. And there was just stuff about us that, you know, we connected over. There was stuff and it was just a different side of him. But he still loved his adopted parents or his, you know, that life that he has. But that was a hard thing, like for someone to process. And, you know, he's probably still not processing some aspects of his life. But, you know, I'm glad to know him. And I feel like there's a lot of people out there that have that same experience. And I think it needs to be brought to the table. But a lot of these people who make the rules, who run these institutions, don't have that life, don't have that perspective. You know, it's hard for them to understand. I could never understand what, you know, my cousin goes through or that amount of time that he didn't know either. But you know, that has a lasting impact when you find out. I'm just curious if anybody's ever reached out to you about your book, Uprooted, it's called, right?
Yeah, Uprooted, Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination is the full title and subtitle of my book. And I have had outreaches by several people, both donor-conceived and misattributed in other ways. Now, let's go over some of the terminology here. We talked about misattributed and the 2 to 4%. This has geometrical questions or implications, rather. You have two parents, right?
Yeah.
You have four grandparents. Well, you have eight grandparents, great grandparents, and then 16, and then 32, and then 64. If I go back to the third to sixth generation, if the 2 to 4% number holds, then my entire high school graduating class of 100 is misattributed to somebody in their family tree up to their third to sixth great grandparent. Think about that. All those stories of family lore might not be so. In my high school class of 100, just with 2 to 4% misattribution, that means that 2 to 4 of my 100 classmates are misattributed. Now, I know I'm one of them. I've had a couple of classmates come to me to say, Peter, you've got some expertise in the DNA area. I've got my 23andMe or ancestry test on me, and I'm having trouble understanding it. Can you help me? And I was able to help them determine that they were misattributed by for whatever the reason. We found the reason and found the source of their seed, but that was three, and I know of one more. So that number is already validated by my own experience since I wrote the book in my class of 100. But I've had reaches from people that have been adopted or people that have learned that they were a product of an extramarital affair, or they learned that Cousin Mary was actually their mom. And and I've had research that I've read in psychological studies, PhD thesis, that all determine that the emotions of misattribution upon discovery are very similar, irrespective of how you were misattributed. I might have felt deceived and relieved all at the same time, and angry and sad, and fulfilled and anxious. And if somebody were a product of an extramarital affair and they learned it, they might feel the same way. There's no bounds to how one feels, and all those emotions are conflicting, and they're valid, and it takes a while to process. And most people that learn are requiring some element of therapy in order to come to grips with the trauma, and it is traumatizing. I can tell you from a very firsthand experience, it is traumatizing.
Were you ever more concerned about the family that you just didn't get to know, or were you more concerned about what health issues could possibly be waiting for you?
Well, I think everyone is a little different, Robbie. For me, I wanted to know what my genealogy was. I wanted my genealogical health history was. I was fearful I was carrying something with my dad's mental illness, and that wasn't the case. I actually felt a little anger about the deception too, because I had made some decisions about my life on the basis of a willful lie, and I was fearful of something that did not exist. For me, I wanted to know if I had any siblings as well. I wanted to make certain I didn't date any siblings. I don't want my children to date a child of a sibling. I don't want my grandchildren to date a child of a sibling. I wanted to know. Smart kids go to smart kids schools. You just never know, especially if they're in the same community.
Yeah, that's a issue with sperm banks. You're not allowed to donate within like three states or something like that. You can't donate to different sperm banks, because that was like an idea to get money.
Who says you can't?
I'm hoping that you can't. They're supposed to check for that.
They don't. There's no law in a book that says that they're required to do that. I'll give you some numbers just shook me. The only regulation there there is an organization that's a trade association, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. They're American in name only because they have membership in over 100 countries. And it's basically a trade association for the fertility industry. And trade associations provide education, they provide networking opportunity, and they provide public policy initiatives. Well, public policy initiatives is another way to say they're a lobbyist, all right? And it's a lot of money in the business, and they're lobbying for self-regulation, no regulation. And they have a recommendation of restricting donors to 800,000 per donor population, 25 siblings per 800,000 population. So use the donor 25 times in a population of 800,000. That's the guidance. That's not a law. That's the guidance. And that's per bank. There's no law saying I can't go to five to eight sperm banks. And there's no requirement for them to check if I went to the other seven. So let's just use that 25 to 800,000 number. That means that if I lived in Sacramento, let's say, I'd have 25 siblings. Now, if I were in metropolitan Boston using that guideline, I'd have 125 siblings from the same donor. But if I were in a larger metropolitan area, New York City, Los Angeles, using that guideline, I'd have 250 siblings. And that's per sperm bank. And there's no restriction on a donor going to another bank. So if I went to four sperm banks in California, in LA, I could have 1,000 siblings. That's 250 times four. So the guideline versus law are two different things. And there's no law on the books here for this kind of stuff. Now, you take the absence of law, you take the advances of science, and you have an issue that is requiring some degree of regulatory oversight, just like the SEC and the FDA and the FTC regulate industries, give oversight to industries for the public good. The same concept is there, for the public good.
Do you think that with the technology advancing in this direction, that there should be just a better education on it as well too? I wouldn't say in schools, but at least there should be a class or something in college, or at least a program that people should be aware of a course that you should take if we're heading in this direction, because it's only going to increase.
Well, what I'm asking for in this donor-conceived Bill of Rights is a mandate for a counseling of both the donor and a recipient as it relates to the needs of the donor-conceived. And that would be a law on the books mandating that. So education, sure.
What about big companies or things of this sort that are involved in this type of work reaching out to you or coming across your book? Like, I've had people that have spoken out against tobacco policy and things of that sort get reached out to by certain members that are involved in these industries. Have you been involved in one of these industries? Because it seems like it's a big thing. It's not a small scale operation.
Yeah, I've been, I've had some outreach by varying organizations to speak at varying events. And you know, this is only April. My book only came out at the end of January, so it's early days. But I've had some outreach, and I am exploring some of those initiatives.
Are you ever fearful that something like this could get you in, there could be a lawsuit or anything of that sort, just a defamation? I understand you're talking about how like the laws, there's no laws prohibiting this type of stuff, but a lot of people be like, you're distracting from business. And I feel like they can have a workaround in that sense.
Well, there's a business in the securities and exchange area. And that's why we have a Securities and Exchange Commission. There's a business in food and drug, but we have a Food and Drug Administration. There's a business in tobacco and alcohol, but we have a Tobacco and Alcohol Administration. There's a business in communications, but we have a Federal Communications Commission, et cetera, all around the public good. So no, I'm not concerned at all, nor have I put out anything that's not true.
Yeah. I'm just curious as if why would it, like, how deep of a dive did you have to go to find a lot of this information out as well too? Is this just common stuff that people can look up and, you know, see for themselves? Or is this just something that like your work, for instance, with going and trying to trace back your roots, you came across this stuff. Was it right there for you? Or did you actually have to go looking and slowly come up with all this evidence that you've compiled? Like, is this something that people can educate themselves on too? And if it is, can we get more of a direction of people's minds heading in that way with a more, as much as people say they're empathic to other people's feelings and well-being, you would think this would be on their priority charts.
Yeah, good question, Robbie. I researched this for 22 years. When I first discovered that I was donor conceived in 1995 and I had no clues and no DNA analysis or anything else, I found some stone walls pretty quickly. And it was therapeutic for me to do a deep dive of research into the whole area of assisted reproductive technology. And I used pre-Google, and when the internet was just in its infancy, I used some old gumshoe techniques of library research between the Boston Public Library and the Harvard Library of Medical History. And I spent a good deal of time doing some of that old gumshoe research. And as the internet became more and more effusive in our society, I was able to do some research there as well. And I looked at it not only from the science vantage point, I looked at it from the sociological vantage point and from the legal vantage point. So my deep dive of research was not a one-week thing. It was a 22-year process. And I have all of that in my book.
Do you have you spoken to any psychologists that deal with trauma that people have experienced from this? I know they can't give you specific details about the cases that they face, but I have to think there's a lot of people, a lot of questions, much like you probably had when you found out as well too.
Yeah, there are researchers out there that I have spoken to, and there are research papers and theses out there that speak to the entire area as well. And I mentioned a piece of it, and that is that irrespective of the reason for being misattributed, the feelings that people have, the emotional response, the traumatic emotional response upon discovery is almost identical in terms of how they feel about the new information that they have. And the researchers have all found and encourage for the assisted reproductive technology industry to let a child know on the front end of their life that they are donor conceived and let it be part of their woodwork. And as a child ages, you can give them more detail on the fact that they are donor conceived. And kids are okay with knowing. It's the trauma of not knowing and then all of a sudden being showered with new knowledge.
Do they know what the proper age is to tell them though?
From the very moment the child is born, let that child be part of his woodwork that he was donor conceived.
Huh. I don't know. Probably is smart to build up around them. It probably builds their character a little bit more too. But I think
let's do same-sex couples and single people.
Yeah.
Kids are smart kids, and they know about the birds and the bees long before they're 15 or 18 or 21 years old. So a child of a same-sex couple will understand that there's something unique in their parenting that their friends don't have. They understand the birds and the bees pretty crystal clearly, and they might have more knowledge than the average heterosexual couple will give their child.
I just look at more of the psychological aspect coming from the parent, from a mother and father aspect, or maybe even same sex, just a rebellious thing that starts to happen. Kids do it even if their parents are their real parents. They go, "You're not my dad, you're not my mom. You're not the boss of me. That type of rebellious thing, the words that cut deep for a lot of parents. That's a lot of fear aspect for a lot of people to tell them something of this sort, because there is that side of the rebellious part. They're not going to listen to you anymore. Which is psychologically, I mean, it's not true in some aspects. They're still going to love you unconditionally, but there's just that psychological thing that deters people from doing so. It's the reason why people keep secrets like this to the grave. They don't want that aspect of thinking differently of you because of something like this.
Yeah, all the psychologists that have studied this have the same recommendation. They've been looking at it several different ways over several decades, and they all say the same thing now. Tell a child very early on. Tell a child if he was adopted very early on. The adoption community started doing that in the 90s. Tell a child very early on if they're donor conceived. Tell a child very early on whatever.
I guess I think what I'm leaning more towards is it's like the guidelines for a sperm bank would be that they should tell you this. There's no law saying it. I'm saying there should be a law that parents should have to tell their kids if they are that, rather than a guideline of just hoping that they do. Because you're going to have a lot of people that aren't going to want to tell their kid that. They're going to be like, this is my kid, whether it was created by this or not. That's true, but you need to let them know. I think there should be a law that requires that as well, too.
There also should be laws on the books that penalize fertility fraud. It might be unethical for a doctor to use his own sperm 100 different times, but it's not against the law.
That's fucking nuts, man. A doctor using... Now, I don't understand. I don't even see a likely scenario of where that would be a positive thing. Why? I don't... Is that a doctor taking the thing into his own hands and deciding that he's going to do this? Or is this just because they couldn't find anything? But I don't even see a possible scenario where they couldn't find a donor.
Maybe all of the above. Back before frozen sperm, it was logistically requiring a live sperm. Live sperm has a 2-hour life out of the body. It may have been logistical. It may have been financial. It may have been just easy to do.
What about people that keep their eggs on ice when they don't want to have a kid right now, but they only have a viable amount of time? They're paying a couple $1,000 or something to keep those eggs on ice every year. What about that? What do you feel on that?
Same concept. And there's also people going through IVF, a couple, a married couple even. They might have 10 eggs that have been fertilized, turned into an embryo. They decide to plant one or two. And what do they do with the others? They may donate them to science. They may donate them or sell them to another wanting couple.
Because I had a past guest, a good friend of mine. They have two kids, but they came out at different times. Like one of them was from a frozen egg, but it's still biologically their parents. I didn't know the stance on that, because besides selling them, just by keeping them on ice, for instance, if you're going to have the kid at a later date, is that okay too?
There's all things that are enabling people to have a family via science, and if they choose to do that, they can do that. The important thing is that the child understand the circumstances of his genealogy early on.
To prevent
an identity crisis. Now, you mentioned something, and we're talking about the methodology, in quotes, the industry methodology of distributing gamete, whether it be sperm, egg, or embryo. This has gone off the rails now via social media, and no regulation around it. You can get a sperm donor, an egg donor, or an embryo over Craigslist.
What? Hang on a second. I understand that. But
there are social media sites that have many, many hundreds of thousands of members for sperm, egg, and embryo. No institution, It's not lawful to sell human tissue. So what they do is they arrange a service fee and travel expenses. I'm not selling you my sperm, but for a service fee, and pay my travel and I'll give you my sperm. And it's done on a catalog. Speaking of eugenics, it's like a match.com catalog. Do I have the right size, shape, color, hair, eyes, or my right education in order to be deemed a desirable donor? Just like on match.com, my kids tell me that you have to kiss many frogs in order to find what you're looking for in match.com. People will lie about who they are and use their high school picture when they're, or use somebody else's picture, or talk about having a PhD and speaking seven languages where they might be a schizophrenic and a convicted felon. That's a real case that has 30 some odd siblings as a result of that. And then there's the 80-20 rule in cataloging. I learned in my business experience that, for instance, in inventory, you have 20% of the inventory favored by 80% of the people, milk, eggs, bread, poultry, what have you. And the other 80% of the inventory favored by 20% of the people. It's no wonder we have hundreds of siblings per donor, no regulation, and the 80-20 rule on top of that.
Yeah, it's like if you gave the option of choosing Brad Pitt or Rick Moranis, there might be a select few like Rick Moranis, but most people are going to pick Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Now, my friends tease me. They say that, Peter, my book has been, your book has been picked up by a movie agent, and Brad Pitt has turned the role down, but Danny DeVito said yes.
Take Danny DeVito. I'd still take him. He's a lovable guy.
I take him too.
Is there any key takeaways that you want the people to keep informed towards the end of the episode before we wrap it up?
I'm all for science enabling people, wanting people to have a family, Robbie. I would like the book to be become a go-to book as an advocacy vehicle for assisted reproductive technology to positively impact the practice of it. And that's for the donors, the recipients, the medical people, the people in psychology, the legal practitioners, and even the legislators. I'd also like to speak for the feelings and the well-being of all misattributed people that experience the same trauma that I have felt. So my open question now is not, do I have any siblings, but how many siblings do I have really? For me, my bonus home run is that I actually have a few siblings that I've met that are nice people. We have a very unique relationship and a real friendship as a result of that. I wasn't looking to establish another family, but I can love my dad and still want to know my genealogical parentage all at the same time. It's not mutually exclusive.
I get what you're saying 100%. I think what people are going to take away is I'm in the same boat. I don't want technology to stop. I don't think it should stop. I think this is a great way for a lot of people that can't have kids, but I definitely stress the importance of advocating for the rights of the people that are conceived by this type of way as well. So that it does include teaching them when they're young about their original, how they were conceived, how were they created, being honest with them. But majority of society never really likes to hear a lot of the bad implications or the bad scenarios of this type of technology. They only want to hear the good type. And then if you talk bad about it, they consider you against the technology. I think what you're doing is of prime importance. I like the advocacy that this book has to being a vehicle for a lot of these people to have a voice in a sense and just stress the importance of it. Education is everything. I definitely think it needs to be taught a little bit more. More people should have this information because a lot of this stuff is mind-blowing what you were telling me. Mostly because a lot of people don't know that this stuff is going on. A lot of people, you know, they don't hear about it on their Twitter feed or something like that.
Well, you can get more information on my website, www.peterjboni.com. And on that, there'll be a link to find the book on a variety of websites to buy the book. And it's also available in your local bookstore. Just ask them for it.
I'll make sure I link it all in the description. Is there anything you want to say before we wrap up the show and I end it?
That's it. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank Podcast.